This episode includes discussion of suicide. Please keep this in mind when deciding if, how, and when you'll listen. For research on these topics, visit spotify.com/resources.
It's daybreak on February 2nd, 1979. New York might be the city that never sleeps, but when you spend every waking hour fueled by booze and drugs, you eventually need to crash. Inside an apartment on Bank Street, Greenwich Village, the inhabitants seem to be doing just that. The place belongs to 22-year-old actress Michelle Robinson. She and her boyfriend both partied hard last night and have yet to surface. Her boyfriend's mom, Ann Beverly, is staying there too, and it's she who wakes first. Ann Beverly yawns, climbs out of bed, and heads to the kitchen. Dotted around are the remnants of last night's celebrations. Ashtrays peppered with cigarette butts, empty bottles and half-full glasses. Anne rubs sleep from her eyes and starts to tidy up as she waits for the kettle to boil. The reason for last night's impromptu gathering was to celebrate Anne's son being released from prison on bail. But despite welcoming him back home, Anne knows he's not out of trouble yet. When he stands trial in a few months' time, it will be for the most serious of felonies: the murder of his ex-girlfriend. If found guilty, he'll be sent to prison for a minimum of 25 years. For someone like her son, who suffers from depression and addiction, Anne worries jail would break him. She knows that he's already living life on the edge, taking too many drugs and drinking to the point of oblivion. Last night at the party, he even overdosed on heroin. Thankfully, he survived, but Anne fears he won't be so lucky again. With these terrifying thoughts swirling through her mind, Anne tries to distract herself by taking the kettle off the boil and pouring out 3 cups of tea. One for herself and 2 to take to her son and Michelle. She stops outside of their room, holding both cups in one hand, and knocks on the door. When there's no answer, she turns the doorknob and walks in. The drapes are shut, and it takes a moment for her eyes to adjust to the gloom. In the darkness, she can just about make out the young couple lying side by side in bed. Anne goes to place their drinks on the bedside table, but when she gets closer, she realizes something is terribly wrong. Her son's face is pale, bordering on gray. He's sprawled on his back, unmoving. She can't see the rise and fall of his chest. By the side of the bed lies a syringe. It only takes Anne a few seconds to realize the awful truth. Aged just 21 years old, her son is dead. The needle by his side proves exactly what killed him. As for his girlfriend, Michelle Robinson, she's sleeping peacefully next to him, unaware of the horror she'll soon wake up to. Anne Beverly takes a step back from the bed, lifting a hand to her mouth in shock. She knows that it isn't just her and Michelle who will mourn this 21-year-old. You see, her son is celebrated throughout the world. His name is Sid Vicious, and he's the infamous bassist of the legendary punk rock band, the Sex Pistols. His death will lead to one of the most enduring mysteries punk music has ever known. At the moment of death, people often have an overwhelming need to get their biggest secret off their chests. From murder, fake identities, illicit affairs, and even government cover-ups, this show dives deep into the world's most explosive deathbed confessions. This is the story of Sid Vicious, of the words spoken about his death. It's about a young man who found his place in the world through punk rock music, his meteoric rise to fame, and a love affair that tore apart his unstable life. It's also about his estranged mother, Anne Beverly, the destructive part she played in his story, and a confession given while she lay dying, which told a worrying story about exactly how her son died. I'm Estefania Hageman, and this is Deathbed Confessions.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
At the time of Sid Vicious's death, he's one of the biggest celebrities on the planet. Fans all over the world know his name, love his music, and despair at his struggles with addiction. But despite his international stardom, one thing no one really knows is what happened the night he died. People wonder, did Sid's addictions finally win and result in a deadly heroin overdose? A fatal byproduct of partying too hard? Or was his death a suicide? Perhaps a desperate way to escape the trauma of his upcoming criminal trial and possible jail sentence. Hundreds of conspiracies and theories spread to try to answer this mystery. But it's a mystery that will remain unsolved for years, long after the name Sid Vicious and the Sex Pistols have faded from the headlines. That is until 2006, over two decades since Sid's death, when a deathbed confession arises. One which tells a new story about what happened the night Sid died and suggests someone close to him played a part. Is it possible that Sid Vicious was murdered? To answer this question, we need to go back to England in the early 1970s, the birthplace of the cultural phenomenon that would come to define Sid's life, punk rock. Throughout the first few years of the 1970s, England is ripe for a revolution. Unemployment is high, the economy is struggling, and the country's youth are looking for a way to express their discontent. Music, so often a mirror for society, provides the answer in the form of punk rock. With its hard-edged lyrics and anti-establishment war cry, it speaks to many that are looking for an outlet for their angst. Front and center of the UK punk scene are the Sex Pistols. First formed in 1975 by manager Malcolm McLaren, they have a reputation for being loud, brash, and controversial. They're made up of lead singer Johnny Rotten, guitarist Steve Jones, drummer Paul Cook, and bass guitarist Glenn Matlock. But although their music speaks to thousands of fans, it's their behavior that really defines the punk era. The Sex Pistols are infamous for getting into fights with authority figures, trashing venues and hotel rooms, and demanding radio stations to play their songs. In fact, their deal with record label EMI is canceled in January 1977 due to a particularly rowdy tour. Following this, bass guitarist Glenn Matlock is kicked out of the band amidst rumors that he's a fan of the Beatles. He's replaced with a 19-year-old teenager, a self-professed die-hard fan of the band, one who's been to every gig, consistently causing scenes with his drunken and aggressive antics. Sid Vicious. Sid is a longtime friend of lead singer Johnny Rotten, so the band welcomes him with open arms. His unusual stage name has an equally unusual origin. It stems from him being bitten by Johnny Rotten's hamster, a creature known as Sid. The comment was made about how Sid was vicious, and just like that, the name stuck. But while his stage name has a humorous history, Sid's own backstory is far from funny. Born John Simon Ritchie, Sid had a difficult upbringing. His father was in the army and left when Sid was 2 years old. His mom, Ann Beverly, remarried, but his stepfather died of a heart attack when Sid was just 8, leaving him without a male role model. Ann and Sid moved around a lot until finally settling in London. But even with a new house in a new city, life didn't get any easier. You see, Ann was addicted to heroin. Her battle against addiction was tough, and at times it meant she couldn't be the mother Sid needed. The two frequently had explosive arguments, which grew in violence and aggression over the years. When Sid was 16 years old, their tensions finally erupted, and Ann threw him out of their home, telling him, "It's either you or me, and it's not going to be me. I have got to try to preserve myself." Sid, still a teenager, was forced to leave. With no mother, father, or even a place to call home, he was all alone. So when Johnny Rotten reached out in 1977 and offered him a place in his band, Sid leapt at the opportunity. Here was a chance to make a new identity, to find an outlet for his rage and angst, and finally escape the trauma of his childhood. But no one in the band knew just how scarred Sid was, or how the pain of his past would soon spell disaster for both himself and the Sex Pistols. It's now March 1977, 1 month since Sid became the band's bassist. The Sex Pistols quickly sign a new record deal, and Sid plays his first official gig to roaring shouts and screams of approval. But there's one problem with Sid's musical dream. He's not actually that great a bass guitarist. He can play, sure, but he's nowhere near as proficient as the recently departed Glenn Matlock. In fact, when the band records their debut album, it's guitarist Steve Jones, not Sid, who plays bass on all but two of the tracks. Perhaps surprisingly, this doesn't bother Sid, the other band members, or even fans. Actually, it boosts the Sex Pistols' popularity. The fact that their bassist isn't a talented musician embodies just how rebellious punk music is, how it subverts the accepted norms and expectations of the industry. As the months pass and the band's fame soars to new heights, Sid throws himself into his newfound life in the spotlight, playing gigs, giving interviews, meeting fans, and catching the eyes of hundreds of girls. It seems to be the lifestyle he's always dreamed of. Now all he needs is someone to share it with. It's the summer of 1977, and 20-year-old Sid is hanging out backstage with his bandmates when a 19-year-old girl catches his eye. The girl is tall, around 5'7", with blonde curls, rouged cheeks, and deep red lipstick. She's chatting with the band's lead singer, Johnny Rotten. Johnny turns away from the girl after a few minutes, and Sid watches as she looks around the room. The pair eventually lock eyes, and she makes a beeline for him. Confidently, in a strong Philadelphian accent, the girl introduces herself as Nancy Spungen. She explains that she came to London from New York, following a band called the Heartbreakers. But recently, she's become a huge fan of the Sex Pistols. As the music venue empties out and the crowds start to disperse, Sid and Nancy continue talking. They realize that they share more than a love for punk music. Both Sid and Nancy are drawn to reckless, bold lifestyles. They love the extreme, the dangerous, and the controversial. Most of all, they're both addicted to drugs. Now that they've found each other, they intend to enjoy the high life quite literally. Not long after their first meeting in London, Sid and Nancy begin a romantic relationship. The pair are infatuated with one another and are rarely seen apart. Their relationship progresses quickly. They buy a house together in West London and rent a room at the Chelsea Hotel in New York. However, there are problems from the very start. Their London home instantly turns into what friends describe as a junkie's shooting gallery, a safe space to shoot up. There are drugs and needles littered over every surface, and the pair spend most waking hours high. What's more, while Sid's love for Nancy is clear for the world to see, Not everyone is equally charmed by her. There are those who feel she exerts too much influence over Sid and is trying to control the young star. Even Nancy's own mother describes her as hostile and demanding. But perhaps most crucially, Nancy is unpopular with the other band members. They can see that Sid is becoming increasingly erratic and unreliable due to his drug use, and he's wearing their patience thin. They don't think it's a coincidence that his drug habits have escalated since Nancy entered his life. In spite of it all, though, Sid's drug taking, his relationship, and the tensions within the band, the Sex Pistols' popularity soars. In July 1977, with Nancy in tow, the Pistols set off on a European tour that sees them play across Scandinavia, the Netherlands, then back to the UK to finish. Their debut album, titled Never Mind the Bollocks, Here's the Sex Pistols, is released in October of 1977. Some retailers refuse to sell it, thanks to anti-establishment tracks like God Save the Queen, but this is exactly the reaction the Sex Pistols want. Their album shoots to number one in the UK charts, where it will remain in the top 75 for almost a year. Due to their stellar success, the band is booked for a US tour for 1978. For four teenagers who grew up in poor London neighborhoods, this is the opportunity of a lifetime. They just have one request. Johnny Rotten, Steve Jones, and Paul Cook ask that Nancy Spungen not join them. They're set in their belief that her influence is damaging Sid and hindering his ability to perform. Sid's desperate pleas of protest are ignored, and the Sex Pistols manager, Malcolm McLaren, agrees. Nancy will stay in London. The tour will be a chance for Sid to get clean. But going cold turkey from Nancy and heroin at the same time is a challenge that will test Sid to his limits and beyond.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
The two-week U.S. tour in January 1978 is almost derailed before it begins. Several of the band have criminal records, meaning they're not eligible for U.S. visas. After hurried negotiations, though, an exemption is made for the young rock stars. Keeping true to the very essence of punk and its tendency for shunning established rules, the Pistols don't play the big city venues you might expect from a world-famous band. Instead, they play smaller gigs in a selection of southern states. Outwardly, the band is a roaring success. Four teenage stars taking over the world. But in reality, the members aren't doing so well, Sid Vicious in particular. Whether it's being apart from Nancy or having to make do with methadone, an opioid used to lessen withdrawal from heroin, life on the road takes its toll. Sid's behavior quickly deteriorates. In San Antonio on January 8, 1978, Sid takes exception to one particular audience member and clubs him over the head with a bass guitar. At another show in Dallas 2 days later, Sid shows up on stage with the words, "Gimme a fix," carved onto his chest and blood smeared across his skin. And minutes before their final gig in San Francisco, Sid locates a supply of heroin and immediately gets high. He's barely able to perform. Sid's harmful behavior is too much for the band to endure. Guitarist and drummer Steve Jones and Paul Cook announce that they're flying to Rio the next day to work on a project together. And Johnny Rotten decides that he's also had enough. He quits the band straight after their final gig. Once again, Sid Vicious is left all alone. Without his friends or music, he boards a plane bound for New York. But his mind must be tormented with the struggles of the past 2 weeks, and there's no telling what he'll do next. Perhaps to quell his worries and guilt, Sid makes himself a cocktail of Valium and methadone while on board his plane. He only intends to numb the pain he feels, but He goes too far. The combination of these two drugs pushes him into a coma. As soon as the plane touches down at JFK Airport, paramedics arrive and throw Sid onto a stretcher. He's rushed through a bitter snowstorm and heavy traffic to a hospital in Queens, where he's placed in a private room and hooked onto machines. Minutes stretch into hours, and no one knows if Sid will make it. Doctors treat him around the clock, willing the world-famous rock star to wake up. Finally, as dawn creeps over the horizon and sunlight spills into his hospital room, Sid blinks open his eyes and groans in discomfort. One of his friends is waiting by his bed when he wakes up. She's a photographer who became close to Sid on tour and saw firsthand the damage drugs were doing to his body. Now, as she sees Sid's pale face, pain etched in every crease, she takes his hand and pleads with him to straighten himself out. But Sid shakes his head. "I can't straighten up," he replies, his voice cracking. "I just can't be straight. My basic nature is going to kill me in 6 months." When the photographer leaves later that day, Sid is abandoned once again. He doesn't have any friends to turn to, and his band members don't want to hear from him. Sid has two choices. He can either reach out to his estranged mother, Ann Beverly, who's currently living in London, or he can call his girlfriend. Sid eventually chooses the latter of the two, and the moment he's discharged, he runs straight back to Nancy. Sid and Nancy fall back into their old routine, drinking and taking drugs from dawn till dusk. Sid shows no signs of slowing down. It's as if the drug-induced coma never happened. Together, they bounce from city to city. A brief stay in Paris sees Sid record three new tracks, as well as filming for a documentary about the Sex Pistols. The rest of his time is spent with Nancy in their various hotel rooms, getting high and drinking to the point of oblivion. Nancy appears to rely heavily on Sid, and one day when he goes to work, she fakes a suicide attempt by superficially cutting her wrists. It's clear that she believes she cannot live without him. But Nancy is not the only woman desperate to have Sid in her life. His mom, Ann Beverly, is also trying to reconnect. Although she and Sid have had a tense relationship over the years, they've always kept in contact. She's proudly followed Sid's success in the band, and he's kept her updated on events in his life. Now that Sid's gone solo, Ann wants to be a bigger part of her son's world. But her actions as a mother are, at times, questionable. On one occasion, shortly after Sid's return to London from Paris, Anne rushes to his house to see him. She's carrying an armful of bags and boxes, which she claims are full of gifts for Sid. After ringing the doorbell and receiving no answer, Anne shouts her son's name. A neighbor emerges and explains that Nancy and Sid are out. At this explanation, Anne hands over the bags she's carrying and asks the neighbor to give them to Sid. But when the neighbor opens them, he's horror-struck. The bags are full of candies and syringes. It's not clear what Ann Beverly means by this gift. Is she trying to do her job as a mother and protect Sid from the risks that come with drug taking and sharing needles, viral diseases such as HIV and hepatitis? Or more worryingly, is she just one junkie enabling another, adding fuel to the fire that's already out of control? Either way, it's not your typical mother and son relationship. And surrounded by two women who seem to aid his drug addiction, surely it won't be long until Sid goes too far again. It's October 11th, 1978. Sid and Nancy are in a friend's room at the Chelsea Hotel, partying the night away. The celebrations have been going on for a few hours now, and Nancy tries to convince everyone they need to get more drugs, something to give the party a boost. Meanwhile, Sid sits perched on the bed, looking wistfully at the stack of old photos of himself. As he does, he strokes the side of his face with a knife that Nancy bought him earlier this week. Nancy scolds him, telling him to put it down, and Sid obliges. It's as if he's a naughty schoolboy obeying his teacher. But while Sid follows Nancy's orders, the rest of the crowd aren't so obedient. They don't get any more drugs as Nancy asked them to, so Sid and Nancy leave at around midnight. But when they reach their own hotel room, it's not to fall asleep and have a quiet night. In fact, they host their own gathering, and this time, there's no shortage of drugs. Sid, Nancy, and their fellow junkie friends create various cocktails of drugs throughout the night. Using medicinal and prescription pills, they get high on substances such as Tuinol and Dilaudid. Gradually, the guests enter drug-induced chaos. Some become high and energetic, others angry and paranoid. Sid, for one, appears drowsy and depressed, the results of having taken up to 30 doses of Tuinol, a potentially lethal amount. The drinking and drug-taking continues well into the next morning, and for all anyone can tell, it's just another drug-fueled party. However, an event will occur in the early hours of the morning, which will make this party infamous. It will become the subject of sinister speculation and scandal for years to come. At around 7:30 a.m. on October 12, 1978, several residents of the Chelsea Hotel hear what sounds like a woman moaning. The moans echo through the hotel's rooms, waking up many of its guests until they eventually stop minutes later. No one thinks anything else of it until 10 a.m. when the phone rings on the front desk. The receptionist sees the call is coming from room 100, Sid and Nancy's home, and quickly picks it up. Sid's voice is slurred and sluggish as he explains someone's sick and needs help. He doesn't say who or what's wrong with them, only that the receptionist needs to call an ambulance. Following Sid's request, paramedics arrive 45 minutes later and head straight up to room 100. What they find is far worse than someone being sick. In the bathroom, slumped against the cool tiles, sits 20-year-old Nancy Spungen. She's squeezed in between the toilet and sink, head hanging down. Blood smears streak Nancy's skin, and there's a single stab wound in her abdomen. Paramedics hastily check for a pulse, but she's already cold to the touch. Nancy is dead. And tragically for her boyfriend Sid Vicious, this is not the only piece of devastating news. Unbeknown to him, he's about to become the prime suspect in her suspected murder. When police inspect the hotel room, they find Sid's hunting knife sitting on top of a suitcase. It's the one Nancy bought him a few days ago. Could this explain the fatal stab wound in her stomach? The knife looks clean, and its sharp silver blade shines in the morning sun, but this doesn't mean it wasn't used. Police show the potential weapon to Sid and ask what it's doing at the scene of the crime. But as soon as they question him, Sid breaks down. As he's interrogated by police officers, he gives a number of contradictory statements. First, he tells officers that he stabbed Nancy but didn't mean to kill her. He doesn't explain why he stabbed her, though. Minutes later, Sid counters this version but claiming he never touched her and suggests she must have fallen on the blade herself. The final story Sid tells is that he barely remembers the night at all. He says all he can recall is waking up at 10 a.m. and finding Nancy sitting on the bathroom floor, alive and breathing. He claims that he then headed out to the methadone clinic to get his prescription. It wasn't until he returned that he saw the blood and called for help. Police aren't impressed by Sid's testimony. It's confused and contradictory. They believe it proves he has something to hide. So later that day, after they've heard everything Sid has to say, they clamp him in handcuffs and arrest him for the second-degree murder of Nancy Spungen. Unsurprisingly, the tragedy is front-page news, with Sid and Nancy's faces plastered all over the papers and TV. The world is divided over Sid's involvement in the whole affair. Thousands condemn him a murderer, while many others, including former Sex Pistols manager Malcolm McLaren, insist he's innocent. One person that rallies straight to his side is his mom, Ann Beverly. Despite the ups and downs they've had over the years, she has his best interests at heart and works tirelessly to prove his innocence. Anne joins forces with McLaren, and together, they find the best lawyers money can buy. They choose renowned New York attorney F. Lee Bailey, known for defending clients such as the Boston Strangler and Patty Hearst. After 4 days of negotiations, on October 16th, their efforts pay off. and Sid Vicious is released on bail. He stumbles out of Rikers Island detox unit, looking as bad as he no doubt feels following days of going cold turkey. Sid's eyes are gray and dull, his skin white as paper. He walks unsteadily into the sunlight, as though the slightest breeze could knock him over. Anne Beverly is waiting outside of Rikers Island for him. The second she sees her son, she rushes towards him and pulls him tight. As her arms wrap around Sid's thin body, Anne promises she'll protect him. It's a naive vow to make, as if anyone could protect Sid from what's to come. The days following his release pass in a blur. Sid's lawyers try to build a case to prove his innocence. They find witnesses from the party that night who are certain Sid didn't kill Nancy. Several partygoers claim there were shady-looking drug dealers hanging around who had a confrontation with Nancy. Could one of these have killed her? Lawyers also discover that there are no prints on Sid's knife, the alleged murder weapon. It will be almost impossible to prove that Sid even touched it. While his lawyers uncover all that they can about Nancy's death, Sid undergoes various psychiatric tests. Doctors and psychologists conclude that he's having suicidal thoughts and advise that he's placed under observation. These suicidal thoughts are reflected when Sid gives a chilling TV interview. He announces that Nancy's death was meant to happen, that she'd wanted to die before she turned 21. Then, when the interviewer asks him where he wants to be, Sid gives a disturbing reply. Under the ground. During this time, it also comes to light that Sid and Nancy allegedly shared a suicide pact. If one of them died, the other would kill themselves. A twisted punk version of Romeo and Juliet. Is it possible, therefore, that Nancy stabbed herself expecting Sid to follow and he backed out at the last second? Or is it true that, as Sid keeps insisting, there's no blood on his hands? It will be down to his lawyers, a New York judge, and jury to decide. The date is now February 1st, 1979, 4 months after he was charged with the murder of Nancy Spungen. And while lawyers work tirelessly to build a case for his innocence, Sid Vicious and his mom, Anne Beverly, attend a party in Greenwich Village. It's being thrown by Sid's new girlfriend, 22-year-old Michelle Robinson, and as usual when Sid's around, the party is fueled by drugs. Surrounded by friends, alcohol, and pills, Sid takes his celebrations too far. Shortly after midnight, he's found passed out on the couch, his face a shade of gray, and his body completely still. Although there's a hospital 3 blocks away, Anne Beverly forbids anyone from taking him there. She's worried the press will have a field day if they find out what's happened. Also, there's a real chance his bail will be revoked due to taking drugs, and he'll be sent back behind bars. Thankfully, Anne's gamble pays off, and Sid is eventually revived. He doesn't take his near-death experience as a warning sign, though, and continues injecting heroin into his veins, even after the last guest has left. In the early hours of the morning, Sid's apartment is finally empty. The only people remaining with Sid are his girlfriend Michelle and his mom, Anne Beverly. The two people who claim to love him most in the world and have his best intentions at heart. However, Sid isn't as safe as you might think. What happens over the next few hours will lead to one of the biggest myths punk music has ever known. On the morning of February 2nd, 1979, Anne Beverly finds her son lying dead in his bed. There's a discarded needle by his side, and coroners conclude he was killed by an overdose of heroin. But what no one knows is why Sid died. In the days following his death, some claim he took his life to escape the chaos around him. They believe the thought of going behind bars was too painful for Sid to bear, and he saw no point in living without his ex-girlfriend, Nancy. Anne Beverly is one of these people. Days after his death is announced, she reveals a note found in one of the pockets of his jackets. It reads, "We had a death pact. I have kept my half of the bargain. Please bury me next to my baby. Bury me in my leather jacket, jeans, and motorcycle boots. Goodbye." However, this doesn't convince everyone. Many people insist that Sid died from an accidental overdose, that he never meant to take it this far. Then, of course, there are those who believe his death confirms his guilt as Nancy's murderer. Unsurprisingly, Nancy's family is quick to support this claim. Without Sid alive to counter or support these theories, the debate rages on throughout New York and the rest of the world. Fans everywhere are determined to know what happened. Among these quasi-detectives is documentary and filmmaker Alan Parker. As he embarks on his mission to discover why Sid Vicious died, he has no idea how dark and twisted the story really is. Alan Parker is approached by Ann Beverly in 1984, 15 years after Sid's tragic death. She reaches out to Parker and asks if he's interested in making a documentary to explore her son's innocence. Captivated by the case of Sid Vicious, Parker agrees at once. As the 1980s pass, he works closely with Ann and listens as she tells stories about her son. Some are familiar tales, those he's heard and read about time and time again. But many are brand new and reveal a side to Sid that no one but his mother would have known. There's one story in particular that stands out to Parker, a story told by Anne in 1996, when she's just weeks away from death. According to Parker, Anne Beverly admits that there's something police don't know about the night Sid died. Anne allegedly reveals that her son didn't overdose by mistake, nor did he kill himself. Someone administered those fatal drugs for him. Anne confesses that this person, the individual who killed Sid Vicious, was her. She apparently claims that in the early hours of February 2nd, 1979, she deliberately injected Sid with a fatal dose of heroin, knowing full well it would kill him. Frustratingly, this is all Anne allegedly shares. She doesn't reveal her motives of murder or explain whether Sid was in on it or not. Just days after confessing to Parker, she dies from a heroin overdose. Her deathbed confession leaves Alan Parker with the biggest secret of punk music in his hands, a secret which has haunted the music industry for decades and driven wild conspiracies and numerous police investigations. A secret which, in a strange and inexplicable twist, Alan Parker decides to keep to himself. For the time being, at least. It's now 2006, 27 years since Sid Vicious died, and a decade since Anne Beverly told Alan Parker that she'd been the one to end his life. Parker hasn't spilled Anne's secret yet, and the world still wonders what happened to Sid. To this effect, a new documentary is being made to cover the last 24 hours of Sid's life. Using information recently revealed by a police officer who was involved in the original case, filmmakers hope to find and broadcast the truth. It's not clear why the officer has waited almost 30 years to share what he knows. But now, he claims that Michelle Robinson, Sid's girlfriend at the time of his death, gave him some interesting testimony. The story is as follows. In the early hours of February 2nd, 1979, Sid asked Michelle to inject him with more heroin. Michelle refused and went to tell his mom Anne what was going on. Anne then disappeared into the room to talk with her son, while Michelle waited outside. When Anne came out, Michelle went back in and laid down next to Sid in their bed. But when Michelle woke in the morning, he was dead. The implication of Michelle's testimony is clear. Anne Beverly provided Sid with the drugs that resulted in his death. She injected him with the heroin that he so desperately wanted, but that Michelle refused to give to him. This means that Anne Beverly may have been responsible for Sid Vicious's death. The filmmakers working on this particular project know that Parker was close with Anne Beverly in the last few years of her life, so they ask him to get involved with their documentary. What they don't know, though, is the secret Parker is sitting on. The deathbed confession, which agrees with Michelle Robinson's testimony and supports the allegation that Anne caused the death of her son. But will Parker share Anne's damning secret, knowing full well that it could provide the key to one of punk music's most enduring mysteries? Or will he keep it to himself? After all, He knows that justice can never be served, seeing as Anne Beverly is now dead. In late 2006, after hearing the testimony of Michelle Robinson, Alan Parker finally decides to share his own secret. He contacts the filmmakers and explains exactly what Anne told him in 1996, how she administered the drugs that killed her son. However, Parker's details about the confession are vague. He doesn't say exactly when or where Anne confessed to him. He doesn't even say why she told him, nor why he kept her secret for over 10 years. All he says is that the confession took place and Anne admitted to him that she was responsible for Sid's death. However, despite Anne's confession, the case is far from closed. Numerous questions still remain. Among them, why did Anne cause the death of her one and only son? Did she worry that he'd be found guilty of Nancy Spungen's murder and be sent to prison? Did Sid ask her to kill him? Perhaps he wanted her to carry out the alleged suicide pact he'd made with his ex-girlfriend. Or did Anne make an awful mistake? She'd been taking drugs herself that night, and it's possible she wasn't fully aware of what she was doing. She may have taken pity on her son's pleas for drugs and believed she was helping him feel better, when in fact, she was killing him. Tragically, though, with Sid Vicious and Anne Beverly both dead from heroin overdoses, we may never know the answers to these questions. Sid's heartbreaking story, one of abandonment, addiction, depression, and tragedy, will be immortalized for generations as a cautionary tale. The dark reality of the drug-fueled high life that punk music embodied. Next week on Deathbed Confessions, we meet Priscilla Bickedike, a mother and wife who finds herself at the center of a scandalous trial. Priscilla and her husband had been going through a rough patch for months, arguing every day and engaging in bitter, aggressive fights. So when her husband suddenly dies of a mysterious illness, Priscilla is thrust into the spotlight as the prime suspect. But is Priscilla really guilty of murdering her husband? Is it possible that their arguments went too far and resulted in his death? Or did somebody else put an end to the domestic disputes for her? A deathbed confession given years later will reveal whether Priscilla Bickedike is innocent or guilty. Deathbed Confessions is a Spotify original from Parcast, produced in partnership with Noiser. Executive produced by Max Cutler, Drew Cole, and Pascal Hughes. Developed by Julian Boireau for Parcast. Series produced by Addison Nugent. Associate producer Nicole Edmonds. Written by Rob Scragg. Supervising editor Jane O. Sound supervisor Tom Pink. Sound design by Cody Reynolds Shaw. Edited by Carla Flores and Rob Plummer. Mix master by Cody Reynolds Shaw. Music by Oliver Baines and Dory McCauley.